From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, refugee and new citizen Edo Makono Zito talks about his journey to the United States and his work helping other refugees.
My mom used to tell me this. Some people went to school to learn how to become leaders. Others, circumstances of life made them leaders. I believe that's how I became a leader.
Then as the turmoil in Chile continues, we hear from a Chilean immigrant now living in Madison.
I got sick because this was really affecting me. It was affecting my relationship. It was affecting my health, my mental health. It brought up a lot of stress into my life.
And our How Did You Do That podcast introduces us to a woman who made the transition from corporate finance to successful entrepreneur. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. Since the mid-1990s, the Democratic Republic of the Congo has been engulfed by civil war. The UN estimates that more than 6 million people have been killed in the conflict, and more than 500,000 people have fled the country as refugees. Many, like Edo Makono Zito, end up in refugee camps in surrounding countries. Most will never find a permanent home. Zito is not like most. He and his family were given the chance to move to Milwaukee. Since arriving, he's used this opportunity to help other refugees here and in his former home, Nyarugusu Refugee Camp. Zito talks about his life and his path to citizenship in a new documentary titled A Hope for Tomorrow. The film will premiere on Milwaukee PBS this Thursday, November 21st. Zito and producer Marianne Lazarski sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the film and Zito's journey.
I was born in Democratic Republic of Congo, but because of the war, my family decided to flee the refugee camp in Tanzania. It was really worse period of time. Congo, since 1996 up to now, we still have a civil war, and especially the place where I'm born, in the east of Congo. The country is really blessed with mineral and resources, and because of that, we have no peace. So my father was working as an immigration officer, and he tried all his best to fight against corruption, but the government didn't like it. So he was murdered. My mom believed that we was not in a safe place. So she did whatever she can as a widow at that time to flee in a refugee camp in Tanzania.
And you were there for a very long time. I knew a fair amount about refugees before watching this documentary, but I'll say I didn't think people would be in these camps for 15 years. Marianne, actually, as you were researching this story, as you were digging into this information, what did you learn?
Well, one of the things that I learned was that the refugees don't have a say in participating in the resettlement program, that the United Nations actually looks at kind of everybody's situation. And in terms of Zito and his family, they decided that, yeah, this is a family that should be resettled. And so it's not like the refugees say, oh, I want to go. You know, it's really up to the folks who are organizing the program to approach them. So that was interesting to me because I didn't realize that. And of course, the refugees don't have a say in where they go. And so coming to Milwaukee, and, you know, Zito could talk about a little bit of a surprise of Milwaukee, a little colder than it probably expected, and snow and such. But again, providing a brand new life for them. But so that was a little surprising how that just the process works. And the other thing that was kind of a wow moment was how many people live in that refugee camp.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about this in a bit, how much it's changed, but a lot of people are living there. And a statistic that you mention inside of the documentary is only about 1% of refugees worldwide are ever resettled. What was it like getting the news that you had a chance to leave?
Oh, my goodness. I was so happy. And to me, that was like the dream comes true. It's something I've been waiting for for many years. My mom is a woman of faith. She was praying God every day, and she believed that hope is coming. That was our prayer every day, every morning, every night. So when we heard that we was accepted, be restored to United States, we had almost a month. It was just a month of prayer, thanking God, like, you're an amazing God who made a new path of our life. Even though we didn't even know anything about United States, we was not there yet. But we forgot all the struggle at the same time. We believe that this is the new hope. This is our future now. That we should think about it.
Well, and I have to imagine after 15 years in this refugee camp, I mean, what was it like learning about Wisconsin, where you were coming, but just about this country in general?
You know, the first time when they told me that I will be going to Wisconsin, especially in the city of Milwaukee, the first thing I did, I took my phone and I Googled Wisconsin just to know what Wisconsin looked like. I went to one of my book of geography. If you go to the map, Wisconsin looked like Tanzania. The map, the way it looks, it's just the same as Tanzania. I was like, wow, this is another Tanzania country where I'm going to live. But I was just reading about the resources and the opportunities, about life of refugees in Wisconsin. That was an amazing research that I did. I believed I will get another chance going to Wisconsin. When I read in that book, it told me that it's a city where all the refugees are welcome. It's a diverse city. They have people who come from all over the countries in the world. So I knew that that would be another place. That should be my place where we get opportunity, and I will live like others.
Well, and something that is mentioned in the documentary is that you didn't actually speak English when you came here. You spoke a number of different languages, but you didn't speak English.
When I say these people, sometimes they don't believe it. They think like maybe I'm joking, but that's the truth. When I came, I spoke zero English, to be honest.
Well, and when you came here, you also started to work with refugee populations. What was that experience like?
My mom used to tell me this. Some people went to school to learn how to become leaders. Others, circumstances of life made them leaders. I believe that's how I became a leader. I didn't start working with the refugees just in the United States. I started working with the refugees when I was 18. I started teaching in high school when I was 19 in a refugee camp because I believed in change. I believed in opportunities. I believed in peace building. How I can be an icon of change of my community. How I can help others to have hope. How I can encourage them to survive. Because the refugees' life itself, there is a lot of story behind it. There's a mental health problems, you know. There's people who have no hope. You have people who already believed they survived, but inside they are dead. So you need to encourage them and show them the resources that we have and the opportunities we have. All my preaching, all my word is about hope. It's about encouragement. We live in a country of opportunity. We can dream bigger and live those dreams in this country. So because of the experience of life that I have, I was working, number one, as supervisor of a daycare. I was working as a teacher in high school. I was working as a social worker on the Child Protection Department. We have a program that we call Child Voice Out. It was just a place where we called all the children with traumatic trauma to tell their story. That was the only way they can take out whatever they have in their minds, because they cannot say it somewhere else. Because of that, and you know, the capacity of the language that I speak, I was able to get a job working with the refugees through Catholic Charities, which I thanks them. They made me who I am. They gave me an opportunity to work, and oh my goodness, with them, we just made a change in Wisconsin. And especially in our city of Milwaukee. We have thousands of refugees. Today, many refugees, they have a job. We connect them with many resources. They have housing. Right now, I work with two different companies, Habitat for Humanity and Strong Block, just to help refugees to buy a house through those programs, I could not have all those resources without Catholic Charities. So I'm really thankful for the opportunity that they gave me.
Well, and it seems like, according to the documentary, that some things have changed at Catholic Charities since you started working there. What, Marianne, what's changed?
Catholic Charities has dropped their resettlement program due to lower numbers, and Milwaukee's not the only city where this happened. Minneapolis, I believe, did the same, and so the numbers aren't quite there, and so that's when Zito had a bit of a change in his life. That's what I understand.
You know, with our new President Trump administration, we have a low numbers of refugees coming to the United States. It's not like it was under Obama administration. And I believe our policies should be the policy of peace building. As we said, United States is a country of immigrants. 99% of the people living in this country are immigrants and refugees, including Trump's wife. She's an immigrant. So because of the low numbers, Catholic Charities decide to close the resettlement program. But even though we close the program, we're still working with the refugees. If I tell you how many calls I receive a day, it's more than 100 just to help refugees. So even though I'm out of the business, I do the same job as I used to do, but I'm not getting paid for. That's the only difference.
Well, and you've continued your work with refugees, not just here, but you actually returned to Nyarugusu. What was that experience like?
First of all, when I went back, some people didn't believe that I will be back in the refugee camp, even though I was talking to them all the time on phones, video calls, that I will be back. To me, I have to pay back whatever the opportunity that I have. I know in the refugee camp, we have children who have the same story as mine. We have widows who have been raped, as my mom, who was one of the victims in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We have orphan children who I believe with my program, with the Zito Foundation, I can help them. Number one, with education. So we provide computer class, it's a free computer class. I was able to do some fundraising in the United States through our United Methodist churches. So some people helped me. They offered me some laptops I took with me in the refugee camp. But the idea that came behind the program was when I went back, I realized that this is the same place where I lived 15 years. And we still have other people living there. The children, the women. And I was like, why me? I thank God more than ever before when I went back to the refugee camp. I ask myself, why have I done to God to get this opportunity? And when I start speaking to the children, telling them how life is in the United States, they was just crying. And asking themselves, why are we still in this country? Why are we still in this refugee camp? It's just like we're still in the prison. Because I believe, to me, refugee camp is just a prison. The good thing about refugee camp is safety. They're safe. They cannot live in a war zone as we was living in Congo. That's all. But there's no opportunities.
Well, and it seems like the camp, since you left, has exploded in population to some extent. There are a lot more people there now.
When I was there, we was like 158,000. So now they have plus 250,000 refugees. It is one of the largest refugee camps in the world.
You know, we've talked, of course, a lot about the refugee situation in the world, but specifically in Africa and Tanzania. Yet I still feel like there's so much misinformation out there. When you're putting together this documentary and when you're thinking about the stories that you want to add into that, what did you feel needed to be included? What was the information that you felt audiences needed to hear?
Well, first, I think people need to hear from somebody like Zito, somebody like the other refugees working at Troubadour Bakery who went through similar situations, to hear their story. You know, you can read in a headline or you might hear on the radio about the war that's going on in the Congo. And we kind of, you know, a lot of people kind of, oh, that's bad, but they tune it out. I think they really need to meet these people and meet them through, right, media and our documentary, and to listen to somebody like Zito and what he went through as a young boy and what the other refugees have gone through, and put a face to those horrible experiences, and then to see how resilient these people are. The horror that they've experienced, that they've seen, that they went through, that their family members went through, and yet they are so thankful, like Zito, for being in Milwaukee, for working at a bakery, for, you know, moving forward, right, and having that opportunity and becoming a U.S. citizen, and how, what that means to somebody like Zito. I think we sometimes take that for granted, right? So I think it's, you know, it's just really important for people to put a face to kind of what they're hearing and realize, yeah, this is happening to people, good people like these individuals. And here they are in our city now trying to make our city better, you know, working hard and trying to improve their lives as well.
Whatever you are a refugee, when you come in the United States, you came under and started what we call A94. Then after 1 year, you can apply for a green card. Then after 5 years, you have to apply for citizenship. But before you apply for citizenship, they have to check on your record, your background check within 5 years. If you committed a crime, no, you can't be a U.S. citizen. It will take you years to clean it up. If you didn't commit any crime, then you have to learn English and learn, you know, those 100 questions about United States. And then you have to take an interview. If you pass the interview, you become a U.S. citizen. But to me, becoming a U.S. citizen, oh my goodness, I don't even know the word that I should put. I was really joyful. I was, my goodness, I was so, so happy to become a U.S. citizen. Because my whole life, you know, I was born in Congo. I did not grow up there. I moved in Tanzania for 15 years in a refugee camp. I cannot say that I get enough opportunity to say, like, oh, I've been in Tanzania for 15 years. Maybe I can claim myself to be a Tanzanian here. And then I moved a new country. Just within 5 years, they recognized my potential. They recognized my work. They offered me a citizenship. Like, hey, we're glad you came in our country. We value whatever you've done to our country. You can become a citizen. You know, that value means a lot in my life.
Well, and certainly there has been some stigma added to refugees under the Trump administration. The limits he's put on refugees, not just compared to the Obama administration, but compared to previous presidential administrations, is very low, historically incredibly low. You know, we talked about Catholic Charities, but I have to imagine that that impacts the kind of aid that is able to be given to refugees in this country more generally. How have you viewed that shift? As somebody who came here as a refugee, how have you viewed the shift under the Trump administration?
And I still keep praying to God, maybe can change our President Trump's views about refugees and immigrants. I believe our president, you know, he's a tough guy. He's a good guy, as he said. He's trying to make America great again. You cannot make America great again without immigrants in this country. You cannot make America great again without refugees. These are the people who work. They came for the opportunity. And as soon as they see the opportunity, they work so hard for those opportunities. They pay tax. So, you know, our GDP is up today because of those people. You know, they help us to clean our city. They buy houses. So compared to Obama and Trump's administration, I'm not trying to be political here, but I think Obama did much to immigrants and refugees compared to our new president, Trump. And what I pray to him is God to give him some wisdom about immigrants to look in other way. Someone who he lived with every day, he sees the face every day. She's an immigrant like me. She just came in 2000 in the United States. He should not forget about that. We should be proud of our diversity that we have. We should be proud of everything that these people do in our country.
Yeah. Well, Zito, Marianne, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate for the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Ada Mokono Zitu is a newly minted U.S. citizen and a refugee from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He was featured in the Milwaukee PBS documentary, A Hope for Tomorrow. Marianne Lazarski is the producer of that documentary. It premieres on Milwaukee PBS this Thursday at 7:30. Lazarski and Zito spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We turn next to the turmoil in Chile and how it's affecting a Chilean immigrant who's now living in Madison. We'll have that story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Chile has been in turmoil for weeks. At least 20 people have died and more than 1,000 injured during protests that began over a hike in subway fares. Those protests, which mark one of the largest public upheavals in the country in a decade, have grown, shifting from anger over transportation costs to a broader call for social reform and a new constitution. Angelina Mosher Salazar spoke with a Chilean living in Wisconsin about how the violence in his home country has affected him and how he's taken action from afar.
Pepe Barros Huffins has been living in Wisconsin for 8 years. He works for the city of Madison, and one day this past October, he was in the car with his wife. She was driving, and
I'm just checking my phone, and then I get this message from old-time friend, you know, a person that we didn't speak to each other for like almost a decade.
The friend tells Pepe that in Chile, their home country, things are bad, really, really bad.
And he's literally in tears telling me that what's happening in Chile is a real crisis. And I'm like, but tell me what's going on, what's happening? Because I was just following the media, you know, but the media wasn't telling a lot those days.
His friend tells him that violence is escalating in Chile, and he has just witnessed it with his own eyes.
So he said, well, just to tell you something, one person just got shot in front of me, like in my street, by the police. So this is going out of hand, and the government is being just manipulating information so nobody knows what's happening, but what is happening is actually very dangerous.
Pepe says when he first hears what his friend says, he's absolutely shocked. Paralyzed. He tries to calm his friend down. He even starts to look for tickets back to Chile, but then realizes that wouldn't do much good. So he starts to go to work on a plan.
Started working on some documents and putting together some data and making like a press release from Chileans outside the country related to what was happening in Chile. But by the time we could even talk about it, the crisis was upscaling very, very quickly.
On October 6th, the government announced that the metro rush hour prices would rise by 30 pesos, or 4 cents, which may not seem like much, but the estimated median monthly wage in Chile is $550. Close to half the country earns this much. Pepe says the protests go far beyond the rise of the subway fare. What really enraged people was the government's insensitive reaction to the public.
They started laughing, literally, at people. They were saying, oh, you can take this as an opportunity to wake up earlier and pay less by wake up earlier. And people were saying that, you know, government were telling that to people that already wake up at 5 a.m. to spend 2 to 3 hours in metro system just to go to work that pays the minimum wage.
Those comments were made by the then Minister of Economy, Juan Andrés Fontaine, and they sparked outrage in a country that ranks as one of the most unequal countries among a group of 30 of the world's wealthiest nations. The comments galvanized students to jump over metro turnstiles and in some cases destroy them instead of paying for the rides.
They decided to skip paying. They didn't buy a ticket for one whole day. So none of them paid, and they all skipped the line and like made this as a way to protest.
Pepe says this isn't a coincidence that the movement began with young people, because they have always driven Chilean social movements.
Again, which is the way that Chilean system work, the students, the ones that are fearless, the ones from high schools and middle schools, they organized.
So it started with students skipping the line, protesting that they wouldn't pay the fare, declaring October 17th, hashtag Evasión Todo el Día, an all-day collective fare evasion. Quickly, the protests spilled out into the streets.
So it grew into other levels, you know, like workers, the workers of health, the workers of the ports, and the transit workers. Everyone started joining this protest. So by day two, nobody wanted to pay, not only students.
On October 25th, a little over 2 weeks after the government first announced the rise in the subway fare, 1 million Chileans marched in the streets of Santiago. Pepe says as the anger and the protest grew, so did the violence.
Half of the train system burned to the ground. And many, many, many buses burned. Many supermarkets burned down to the ground. Many pharmacies burned down to the ground.
Looting, vandalism, and arson have caused billions of dollars of damage to businesses and crippled part of the capital's public transportation system. President Sebastián Piñera declared a state of emergency. Chile was on fire, and meanwhile, Pepe is in Madison.
Well, it was pretty hard for me because I really wanted to be there. But I guess the only position that I could take was sharing information.
Pepe did the only thing he thought he could do. He started sharing everything he got on all his social media networks to family, friends, activists in Chile. And then he started to see that what was happening in Chile was starting to make headlines around the world, including NPR. This is reporter Paige Sutherland.
Chaos ruled in Santiago this weekend. Throughout the city, you could see clouds of smoke rising from fires, and you could hear the banging of pots and pans. A traditional form here of political protest.
Pepe says that he had to take a step away from social media and what was happening because weeks in, he realized it was taking a heavy toll on him.
Yeah, I got sick because this was really affecting me. It was affecting my relationship. It was affecting my health, my mental health. It brought a lot of stress into my life.
Pepe says he hopes nothing but the best for Chile.
Chile has a pretty big part in my heart, you know, and of course I want better things for everyone, you know, a better, happier world, and I'm just sad that so many people has to suffer this in order to make real changes.
At the time of this airing, protests still persist in Chile. And after 3 weeks of unrest, it's reported that 2,500 people have been injured and at least 20 have died, including several killed by police or military. Chileans in the streets are demanding the resignation of President Sebastián Piñera, amongst other reforms. For Lake Effect, I'm Angelina Mosier Salazar.
WUWM reporter Angelina Mosher Salazar spoke with Pepe Barros Huffins, a Chilean immigrant living in Madison, about the ongoing protests in Chile. Last Friday, the Chilean government agreed to hold a referendum on the country's constitution, asking voters whether it should be replaced, and if so, who should draw up the new constitution. We will take a short break, and then our next How Did You Do That podcast introduces us to a woman who made the transition from corporate finance to entrepreneur. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's time now for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
My husband and I moved dual career to France. We didn't speak French. We'd never been in the medical business, and I was 6 months pregnant. with our first child. So when I do write that book, it's going to say this was probably too much change. It's the closest I've probably come to failing. And at the same time, it was exhilarating.
After graduating from the University of California, Davis, with an economics degree, Laura King got a job on the corporate audit staff at General Electric. She rose quickly through the ranks, and after a series of high-level jobs, was promoted to run GE Healthcare's $1.2 billion interventional cardiology and surgery business, and she became an officer of the corporation.
It was there at the top that Laura began to question whether there was a better way to satisfy her passion for clinical innovation. She started thinking she might prefer running a mid-sized private equity-backed company.
The startup world, however, intervened. A Madison venture firm hired Laura to analyze a young company called New Wave Medical, which turned out to have a great technology, but no revenue. Laura became New Wave's founding CEO and grew it from nothing through a successful sale to Ethicon, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson.
Hey, Laura, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks, Tim and Kathleen. Glad to be here.
So, Laura, you grew up in a family of strong women. Tell us about that and how it influenced you.
Heritage is so important to how we view the world. I had a grandmother who was born in 1907, who has not only a college degree but a master's degree as well. My own mother grew up in the 40s and 50s, and she chose between secretary and teacher. She chose teacher. But then in her 50s, she started her own company, grew it, sold it to a Canadian multinational. So I have some entrepreneurial roots, and I have very strong roots around women and accomplishments. So what I'm very thankful for is that we've progressed. You know, people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg really changed labor law in the 70s that enabled people like me to run a $1.2 billion business in GE and to be an entrepreneurial CEO. And yet, even as a medical device CEO, I do a lot of fundraising. And I do it through the venture capital community. And even as we sit today, less than 10% of venture capital dollars go to women-led companies. So it does mean that while I have a very strong heritage, I also have a responsibility to not only mentor women to be good at that, but also to make sure that any kind of equality is really moved forward every day.
So upon graduation from college, you had job offers both from Kidder Peabody and General Electric. Tell us why you picked GE.
So at the time, Kidder Peabody was only an investment bank, and investment bankers are pretty solo. They make money on other people's money. And on the other hand, GE had a lot of amazing products and services and was much more team-based. And I think it's at that point that I really understood my motivations were around team and around creating something that was going to have a broader impact.
Who offered you more money?
So Kidder did offer me more money at the time. But I would always urge everyone, do what you love, because you're going to be really, really good at that.
Well, so you went to GE. You had 8 different jobs there. You were manager of finance at GE Motors. You were 27. That's impressive to me. You ran interventional cardiology in your early 40s. It's interesting to me. Often you didn't have a background in the technical aspects of the business you were running. How did you run those businesses without the deep knowledge that some of your staff had?
Yeah, great question, Kathleen. I think when you come in and you first start your career, it's really important that you bring some core skill. Could be supply chain, engineering, might happen to be finance and economics. And I spent a good 8 to 10 years in my deep core competency where I really understood financials, economics. And then when you become a general manager, a CEO, what you need to make sure is that you, A, ask really good questions, that you listen really effectively to the answers, and that you also make sure that you surround yourself with people who have very complementary skills. And both of my co-founders for both of my startups, both New Wave and Allucent Medical, I have a medical founder, Dr. Fred Lee, and a technical founder, Dan Vanderweide.
It's all about teams with you, isn't it?
It is all about teams with me.
So at one point in the early 90s, GE Motors was facing some tough decisions, and Jack Welch was the CEO at the time, and this was during his Neutron Jack period, where he was famous for cutting workforces relentlessly and had a pretty fierce reputation. And yet you took a risk and talked to him over dinner about problems at GE Motors. Tell us about that.
Yeah. This is probably falls into the category, Tim, of make active choices. If you don't make active choices, choices will be made for you. And I ended up at a leadership meeting where the seating was random. You got a number when you walked in the door. I ended up sitting next to Jack Walsh at dinner. And this is, as you said, a time where you could be, you'll either be fired or promoted after dinner probably. So if you're going to speak up, you know, make sure it's good. And as a leadership team for Motors, we were facing laying off an additional 200 people or moving the entire group to what we considered a preferred provider plan in the healthcare system. And in the 90s, there weren't any of those. But for us, it came down to really needing those individuals still to run our business. And corporate had turned us down, saying you must stay with the traditional, you know, healthcare plan as it exists today. So I brought it up at dinner. As you might imagine, it was relatively controversial. But on the flip side, what happened is actually I talked about the merits and we convinced corporate to let us go this route, which enabled us to keep 200 people in the business that we absolutely needed. And I think it's in that level of risk taking that sometimes your best and your most passionate, you know, avenues are forged.
So what did Jack say when you brought it up? What was his reaction?
Well, his reaction was like, he asked, like a good leader does, he said, he asked one of the HR guys sitting at the table, so what do you think, right? And so a real discussion ensued about the pluses and minuses. And from there, he did put me on the slate to run the mammography business. And that, for me, led to a dual career move to France. I will tell you, my husband and I moved dual career to France. We didn't speak French. We'd never been in the medical business. And I was 6 months pregnant with our first child. So when I do write that book, it's going to say this was probably too much change. It's the closest I've probably come to failing. And at the same time, it was exhilarating. It was higher risk. I clearly have, at least by corporate standards, some higher risk tolerance, which is probably why I'm an entrepreneurial CEO now. And at the time, one of the things that I was most passionate about, and I think this is where I learned that I was very passionate about clinical innovation, is that I advocated kind of relentlessly for going digital in mammography. And that might sound like kind of a simple item now because we are all digital, but the tissue density differences in mammography between cancerous and non-cancerous tissues are very small. So digital in breast and in mammography makes a huge difference, whereas you can see a broken bone either way. And so I actually went back and ended up, the chairman actually funded me $3 million to start digital mammography. And so I would just tell people, as you think through your life, there's no real downside to being passionate about what you love and speaking up, because you're going to land on your feet, you're going to do fine, and you can actually really accomplish something pretty remarkable by going a little further out on your limb.
So you were always a risk taker within GE. And it paid off. You got to a very high level at GE, and then you sat back and started questioning that. And what's amazing to me, you know, being in that corporate setting, you thought about leaving it. I often wonder, you know, Scott Button at Venture Investors in Madison hired you to perform due diligence on New Wave. I wonder what he was thinking. You know, whether he thought he might be hooking you in, and what made you decide to give up that high-level job and just for a startup that had no revenue?
Yeah, it didn't even actually have a product at the time, Kathleen. It was kind of in the basement of my technical founder's house, to be honest. But I think that from my mammography job, I'd learned that I love clinical innovation. And while, listen, I love so much of what I learned at GE. There's no comparison. But I was very far away from real, what I would consider revolutionary innovation versus incremental innovation. And it's very hard for big companies. They have lots of people. They have lots of process, all good process that I learned. But they can't move as quickly as a startup. They can't take the level of risk that a venture capital would take. And so my husband and I talked about it, and we said, listen, this will be probably our best or our worst financial decision, one of the two. There's probably not a lot of middle ground. And for me, it offered an opportunity to really reinvent myself, you know, partway through my career into a much more entrepreneurial style and fast-paced. And I love working with physicians and really having the opportunity to bring something that's going to make a difference for patients to market.
Tell us about New Wave's technology and how you grew the company from the basement to where it is today.
Yeah. So at New Wave, we actually use microwave energy to ablate cancer tumors in liver, kidney, lung, and bone. And it did start in the basement. The Series A was led, as Kathleen mentioned, by Scott Button at Venture Investors.
Can you tell us what ablate means?
Sure. Ablate is to kill or to necrose. So while there are cells that are resistant to drugs and all sorts of therapies, if you take a cell above 6 degrees Celsius, it will die. So by raising the temperature of the cell, being the cancer cell, you can actually kill or necrose that tissue. And so we went from funding to first patient, including our FDA clearances, in 3 years, which I'm sure if you're in the e-commerce space sounds like a really long time. But in the world of medical devices, that's actually very fast because of the level of, you know, regulatory biocompatibility and all the testing that's required to do that.
And how many jobs did you create?
So we actually ended up creating at least 100 jobs inside the company. But actually, our supply base was very local here in Wisconsin. We kind of had a philosophy to have all of our suppliers within a two-hour radius. And that leads, again, to a lot of collaboration. If there's any questions about specifications or quality, you can actually fairly easily get together and make sure that on a face-to-face level, what I said and what you heard were the same thing. And so we grew it until 2016 when it was purchased by Johnson & Johnson.
So many medical device inventions, companies, product ideas fail for lack of acceptance. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, so that's a really important point, Tim, because so many times people do have a great technical solution and they don't think about how it gets adopted. And you have to think about not only the specialty you're getting adopted by, but how much change it is for them. And that's why we've always had a medical founder who's actually very deep. So Dr. Fredley was a leader in ablative therapies at the time. So he could really help guide us in how we design that product.
Your team stayed together after the sale, and you launched a new startup that you're involved with now called Allucent. Can you tell us about what kind of opportunity you have there and what you guys are doing?
Sure. So I have the same two co-founders, Dr. Fredley, who's an abdominal radiologist, and Dan Vanderwijde, who's a professor of computer and electrical engineering at UW-Madison. And we are a little different than most startup teams. We believe in always starting with a clinical need and then believing we can bring the right engineers to the table to solve the problem. So the clinical need at Allucent, we were trying to enable the surgeon to get back to the location of a malignant tissue biopsy. And that was largely for organs that have no anatomical landmarks. So breast, lung, lymph nodes have almost no way, excuse me. And what we did is we created a GPS way to guide them in surgical navigation back to the location of that surgical biopsy.
And how's that doing?
So thankfully, we also went funding to first patient in 3 years again. So we did our first patient in May of this year, and we are now at 8 sites around the U.S., including with Dr. Dana Henkel at St. Mary's in Madison and our founder, Dr. Lee Wilkie at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So let's talk a little bit about all these teams and people you've selected. You told us earlier you have a list of verbs you want to hear in job interview and a list of verbs you don't want to hear, assuming that no one who's interviewing with you tomorrow is listening to this. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. One of the things I really appreciated most about my GE time outside of learning really good process, having great mentors, is the amount of training I got, Tim. And I actually had 80 hours, if you believe it or not, of interviewing training. And I actually got an opportunity to look at the statistics about what makes people succeed in their roles. And the only actual predictor of future performance is past performance. And it doesn't have to be in the same thing, but you need to be able to bring demonstrated evidence to an interview of something you did in the past that's going to be applicable to your new role. So it's not going to be the exact skills, but it's going to be things like problem solving. It's going to be resiliency. And when you ask someone, for example, even something like, if you had a project you'd go back and do over again, what would you do differently? You know, if they can't give you an answer, they either A, don't have self-awareness, right, which is an important skill to bring to any role, or they haven't really pushed themselves, right? And in a startup, you got to push. You got to go out on the edge. And understanding how they talk about that is important. So as you might imagine, we're looking for words like invent, design, sell, words like oversee, approve, and review. We just don't have any jobs like that. So we are looking for people who have very active verbs in their interviews and can really demonstrate at a detailed level what they've done in the past that would enable them to be successful in our roles.
Laura, you did synchronized swimming and played varsity softball, both team sports. You call yourself a team guy. What is it about teams and building teams that you're so attracted to and it seems like is part of your recipe for success?
That's a good question because it asks, you know, how am I motivated? And I think everyone's motivated differently. And what motivates me is seeing someone who I've played some small role in mentoring do really well. It often reminds me of Margaret Mead's quote that says, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And the same thing's true in business. If you really want to make a revolutionary product, it takes a team and a group. It's not one individual to really bring something forward. And that's why you look for a diversity of skills and backgrounds and expertises, because only with that can you create something more meaningful.
Well, don't you love that moment when someone else does something and you think, how did that get done that well, right?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a motto that says, if you fail to expect anything but the best, you tend to get it. And I think people are capable of so much more than sometimes we give them credit for if you just enable them to, you know, largely get out of their way and do their very best work.
Well, Laura, thank you for being here today. It's been great.
Thank you so much.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting WUWM.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
We have time for some music today. Back in September, Canadian guitarist Antoine Dufour spent a week teaching at UWM's Fingerstyle Guitar Program. Dufour has a long history with Milwaukee. He signed with Candy Rat Records in 2005, before the label was actually open for business. He remains one of the label's most popular artists, and he's released 6 albums, 2 DVDs, and has more than 50 million views on YouTube. Dufour came into the studio and played 3 songs for us. This one is called Mother. Thank you.
Canadian guitarist Antoine Dufour performed his composition Mother in Lake Effect's performance studio back in September. Our in-studio concert was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you.